The Path to Happiness by Sayale Susila. The key to happiness, generosity, not harming others, loving kindness, letting go of the attachment to mind and body. All beings love happiness, seek happiness, and avoid suffering. Unfortunately, most beings think that happiness comes from the external, from the pleasure of sights and sounds, smells, tastes, touch, and mental objects. Our eyes are constantly seeking pleasant, agreeable sights. We spend our time watching movies, looking at magazines, and going shopping. Men search for beautiful women. Women beautify themselves to attract men. Our ears are constantly seeking sweet sounds, music, and praise. Our nose wants good and fragrant smells. Our tongue desires delicious and sweet tastes, the taste of food, alcohol, and drugs. We eat not to sustain the body, but to satiate our craving. We overeat and then later try hard to lose weight. Many people crave for wine and liquor to the point of becoming alcoholics. And our body longs for a soft touch, a soft bed, clothing, and of course the touch of a loved one. Our mind indulges in all types of fantasies, planning and expectations for the future, sweet memories of our past. Due to this wrong perception, that happiness can be gained through the enjoyment of these six external objects, beings do not look inward to the source of true happiness. We think that these six external objects can provide us true happiness and satisfaction, and our actions follow from such thoughts accordingly. So with our body, we seek all types of enjoyment through the six sense objects, forgetting the danger in that enjoyment, forgetting that the more we enjoy sensual pleasures, the more we get addicted. The pleasant feeling experienced from enjoying these objects gives rise to craving, and dependent on intense craving, clinging arises. We find ourselves clinging to these six external objects until we are unable to let go of them. We become enslaved, performing different types of bodily and verbal actions to satiate the craving. These bodily, verbal, and mental actions are, according to the teachings of the Buddha, karma. And the law of karma says that when there is an action, there is a reaction. When you throw a ball onto a wall, the ball rebounds. It doesn't go to someone else, it bounces back to you directly. These actions leave behind karmic energy, which is latent in the stream of our mind and body. When this karmic energy meets with favorable conditions, the results appear. The fruit arises. Then we have to pay for the karma. How do we become enslaved in sensual enjoyment? Let me give you an example. Sometimes we have sores on the limbs, and they cause so much itchiness that we have to scratch them. But we also know the more we scratch, the worse the wounds will be. Yet we cannot control our mind not to scratch them. Why do we continue scratching them? This is because when we are scratching those sores or wounds, we find a certain measure of satisfaction, almost enjoyment, even though it makes the wounds worse. But we do not care about the effect. What matters more is the satisfaction and pleasurable feelings that the scratching stimulates. It is the same with all sensual pleasures. The moment you enjoy a sensual pleasure, of course it gives you satisfaction and pleasant feelings. But the wounds and the injury it causes cannot be underestimated. The Buddha compares sensual pleasures to a man taking a blazing grass torch and running against the wind. As he runs against the wind, the fire of the torch invariably blows backward against the man. Only by letting go of that blazing torch will he escape from being burnt. Of course, there's no wrongdoing if we enjoy what we get lawfully, but there must be a limit. Let's say there's a bottle of honey, and an ant likes sweet honey. The moment the ant sees the honey, it goes inside the bottle to taste it. If the ant just takes one sip to satisfy its thirst, it is fine. However, most ants are unable to be contented with a single sip. They will continue to sip the honey, and eventually they will drown in the honey and die. This is the danger inherent in sensual pleasures. Whenever craving for sensual pleasures increases, our body and mind become hot, agitated, and confused. We are tormented on the spot due to lust. There is no inner peace. It is important to understand that the enjoyment of the six external sense objects can never bring us lasting happiness. What, then, are the ways to true happiness? Happiness has many types or levels, from gross to subtle. Sharing what we have with others. This is called dana, or charity, in the teachings of the Buddha. Whatever we have, be it money, knowledge, material things, sweet words, care and love, or inspiration, we share our possessions with others who may need these things. To us, offering others a meal may not be a significant act, but it could be very significant to a hungry person. When we see others using the things we have given them, and we see they have benefited, that they have become happy, we ourselves in turn become happy. I think most people practice this type of charity. This is one type of happiness. By giving away some of our material things to others, we also find another type of happiness, which comes from non-attachment to our own property. We know that when life comes to an end, we have to leave everything behind. Our big house, our car, our money. We can't even bring 1 cent along. What, then, do we bring along when we pass away? Skillful and unskillful karma. Most people die experiencing fear and bewilderment, unable to depart from the wealth they hold dear. Frequently practicing charity during one's life gives happiness and solace when reflecting on it during one's dying moment. Such generosity becomes the path leading to heaven. But if while alive we are unable to share a little of what we have with the needy, we accumulate the karma of stinginess rather than generosity, and this paves the way to an unhappy rebirth. Since we know we have to die eventually and leave behind all our property, why not practice non-attachment to our property while we are still alive by sharing what we have with others? By practicing generosity in the present, we not only make it a habitual karma, but also experience happiness here and now. So we gain two types of happiness by practicing generosity. Happiness gained through sharing with others, and happiness gained through non-attachment to our own property. These are the so-called gross forms of happiness. A more subtle type of happiness develops from there, not harming others. People harm each other through physical and verbal actions. A person brings physical harm to others through beating and killing them. We even kill animals for our enjoyment. Verbally, we harm others through telling lies, speaking harshly, and spreading malicious gossip aimed at disrupting the harmony between two parties. Not harming others is to be achieved by way of restraint. We restrain ourselves by following the 5 precepts, or 5 morality trainings. 1. Abstaining from killing. 2. Abstaining from taking what has not been freely given by others. 3. Abstaining from sexual misconduct. 4. Abstaining from telling lies. And 5. Abstaining from taking intoxicants. Simply taking drugs is not necessarily unwholesome, but when people consume alcohol and drugs without limit, they lose clarity of mind. The mind becomes out of control. At that time, a person can do anything and yet not be aware of the possible consequences. I have had devotees tell me, "When my husband is not taking any alcohol, he's completely fine. He's a good person. But the moment he gets drunk, he starts to beat me up, scold me, and even beats my son and daughter. He becomes a madman." So we avoid taking intoxicants because once one loses clarity of mind, one is capable of performing many unwholesome deeds, which will harm both others and oneself. One's practice of self-restraint is based on two considerations: compassion for others and an understanding of the law of karma. Out of compassion for others, we abstain from killing. All beings love their lives. For example, let's say one night you are walking down a street. Suddenly a robber appears with a knife, places it against your neck, and threatens to cut your throat. How would you feel? Scared. You would feel fear. Fear of what? Fear of being harmed, of being killed. Why are we afraid of being killed? It's because we love our lives. We want to live. All sentient beings, including animals, also love their lives. They also do not want to be killed. Thus, the Buddha said that those who love themselves should not harm others. So out of compassion for others, we abstain from unwholesome bodily conduct and unwholesome verbal conduct. Understanding the law of karma is the second consideration. The law of karma says that good begets good, bad begets bad. When we harm others, the result of that unskillful karma will return to us eventually. When killing other beings, there is volition, the intention to make their lives short. As a result, our lives will become short. In this world, you can see that some people live long while others live for only a short time. Some die at the age of 15 or 20, and many die while still in the mother's womb. Why is this so? Everything that happens depends on causes and conditions. Nothing happens without a cause. Those who die very early are experiencing the results of their previous karma of killing. By understanding the law of karma, we abstain from killing because we love ourselves and we want to live long in this world. In addition, by not harming others, we ourselves are protected from and by the law of karma. This protection is internal, not external. The Buddha once described the difference. When a king and his ministers go out, they are protected by many bodyguards. But this protection is not real protection. It offers no guarantee. Haven't we seen many presidents of different countries shot dead? But if we practice self-restraint and do not harm others by bodily or verbal actions, we are protected internally by our wholesome karma and are safe even without all those bodyguards to protect us. Internal protection is much more important and lasting than being protected externally. Being protected by our virtue internally, wherever we go, we become fearless. Fearlessness is very important, especially in the U.S. Many Americans have told me they have so much to fear and worry about, fear of being shot on the streets. How do we overcome all these fears? If one keeps one's morality pure, never harming others by body, speech, and thought, one will automatically become joyful and fearless. Wherever I go, I'm not worried what will happen to me because I trust my own good karma to protect me. Even if I were to be harmed, I would think wisely, it is just the result of my past unwholesome karma. I'm paying my debt, that's all. This fearlessness is a kind of happiness. It makes the mind light, courageous, and free. However, if you have caused harm to others before, it is never too late to practice self-restraint now. Self-restraint gives internal protection and enables one to live without fear. This means possessing confidence in life even while facing danger and death. Life becomes happier and lighter. This is the second kind of happiness. The happiness that comes from inner confidence based on not harming anyone through verbal and physical actions. Now we come to the third type of happiness. This is the happiness that comes from not harming others mentally. Physically and verbally, we may not harm others, but sometimes mentally we may wish our enemies to be harmed. The moment this unskillful thought arises in our mind, the mind starts to lose its peace and happiness. How do we overcome this mental harm? We do this by cultivating loving kindness, metta meditation. Metta is unconditional or universal love, a love without attachment, simply wanting others to be happy without any expectation. In metta meditation, we radiate thoughts of loving kindness to others by sincerely wishing that they be well, happy, and peaceful, free from enmity and all other defilements. Thoughts of loving kindness will produce many good vibrations or energy emanating from us that will have a positive effect on ourselves and others. Metta enhances good health and good relationships with others, even with our enemies. However, radiating loving kindness to our enemy is not an easy task. Therefore, we begin the practice by sending the metta to ourselves first. Again, this may be very difficult for some Americans, as many of them have told me they have self-hatred. In that case, a skillful means may be to start with your pets. Most Americans like pets. Some like their pets even more than they like most human beings. One day I asked an American woman who has many pets, "Why do you like pets so much?" She answered, "When I get angry with them, at least they never argue back." So start with your pet, and if it is successful, then you can switch to radiating metta to yourself. May I be well and happy, may I be loving. Try to visualize the happy times you have had in your life. Think of your good qualities to arouse your joy, or think how lucky you are being able to practice the teachings of the Buddha. Keep repeating these messages until your mind is peaceful and becomes happy. Next, we radiate metta to our respected teacher wholeheartedly until joy and happiness arise in our heart. Keep his or her smiling image in mind. May you be well and happy. Feel your love enveloping him or her. Then we proceed to a lovable friend with the same wishes. It is not difficult to radiate love to our good friend, right? When the mind becomes light and joyful, move to a neutral person. To radiate love to a neutral person takes a little more effort and time. But when the mind is suffused with love for our respected teacher and friend, with the power and momentum of that developed mind, sending love to a neutral person becomes easy. To each person, we repeat the above phrases until the mind becomes happy. Lastly, radiate metta to your enemy, but do not begin with the enemy you hate the most. Although mentally you may say, "May my enemy be well and happy, may he or she be free from suffering," if you are unable to forgive the hurt he or she has inflicted on you, you may end your meditation wanting to give him or her a punch. This is because we have not fully developed our minds yet. First, choose someone you only slightly dislike. Once you succeed in sending loving kindness to him or her, change to another person you dislike a little more, until you reach the enemy you hate the most. And if you do not have any enemies in this world, that is a blessing. You do not have to send your loving kindness to an enemy. Although we may not hate anyone, somebody may not like us. So those who do not like us should be considered as our enemies. Radiate metta to them. One day, when you meet them, they may start to smile at you, greet you, or even send you a gift. At that time, abundant happiness will arise in you. You will have softened the hatred. And don't think that this is a miracle. It does work very well. I would like to share with you my own experience. Many years ago, when I was in Malaysia, I was living with a fellow nun and a young lady. This young lady was behaving rudely toward us constantly without any apparent reason, and I was beginning to feel uncomfortable due to her behavior. One day I felt I should do something to improve the situation. Remembering the Buddha's words, "Anger cannot be overcome by anger," I decided to radiate loving kindness toward her. Keeping her image clearly in mind, I repeatedly and sincerely sent her the following thoughts for half an hour. May you be well and happy, free from all anger. Afterwards, I returned to my room. Before I stepped inside, the other nun told me that the young lady had prepared two gifts for us. Wow, what a surprise! It was truly beyond my expectations. She presented me with a gift by respectfully bowing three times. And from that day forward, she became much more cordial, and we lived in harmony until we departed. See? The power of metta. So this loving thought itself has great power. You must have faith in it. Try it out for yourself. If you have a lot of enemies, you should try this even more. It'll improve your personal relationships. If you try it on your boss, you may even get promoted. If you are the boss of a big company and you want to ensure productivity, try radiating metta to all your staff. You may try it, especially for those employees who never seem to listen to you. Once we are skilled in metta meditation, we can directly radiate metta to those who hurt and abuse us, and by doing so, fill ourselves with happiness. In this world, even if you were the Buddha, you cannot avoid people harassing you or abusing you. These are called the eight worldly conditions: suffering and happiness, fame and disrepute, gain and loss, praise and blame. Through our mastery of loving-kindness meditation, we repay our enemy with patience and love, winning the battle that's hard to win. If we return an angry man's anger with our own anger, we are like someone trying to pick up a fireball to hit another, but end up burning ourselves first. Instead, we should wish him to be well and happy, free from mental torture, free from anger. The person who utters abusive words and tries to hurt us is the one who loses. In order to utter abusive words to hurt somebody, one must generate anger first. Without anger, one cannot utter harsh speech. So he is the victim of his own anger when he abuses us. Although apparently we are being abused, in actuality he suffers the mental torment first. If we do not react with anger, he is the loser. He loses happiness now and hereafter, according to the law of karma. Understanding this, we can shift our attention from radiating metta to radiating compassion. When we are armed with compassion, our enemy may harm us physically or verbally, but never mentally. If none can harm us, this is a great blessing. Reflecting wisely in this way, we become even more fearless. Endowed with metta, wherever we go, people love us because we love them. One does not feel lonely anymore. This is the third type of happiness. Now we come to the most subtle type of happiness, the most difficult to achieve. The former three types are considered easy in comparison. The last and true happiness comes from letting go of the attachment to the body and mind. Everyone is attached to the body. Because of that, when the body feels sick or when any disease occurs, we feel depressed and become unhappy. That unhappiness and depression makes our health even worse. Have you ever investigated why we feel unhappy when the body is sick? The cause lies in the deep attachment we have to the body. For an arahant, an enlightened being, who no longer feels any attachment to the body, whatever happens to his body, he only feels the pain physically, but not mentally. Ordinary people feel pain physically as well as mentally when the body is sick. This is because we are attached to and identified with the body as mine and myself. This attachment and wrong identification comes from not seeing the body as it really is. The body is just a concept. The four elements that make up the body are ultimate realities, and this is what we all must learn. This can be realized by practicing the four elements meditation. The four elements are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the wind element. The earth element is not referring to the earth itself. The characteristics that this element carries and bears are what categorize it as the earth element. The earth element has six characteristics: hardness, roughness, heaviness, softness, smoothness, and lightness. You can feel the earth element all over your body. For example, when you touch your bones to your head, you feel hardness. This hardness is the earth element. Sometimes you feel softness. This is also the earth element. Hardness and softness are relative. The water element has the characteristic of flowing. Our tears flow, as do saliva and blood. The water element also has the characteristic of cohesion, which makes the organs cohere together so they do not scatter. The fire element has the characteristic of heat and cold, which are also relative. When the element is hot, it has the characteristic of heat. When the element is less hot, it takes on the characteristic of cold. The heat that warms up the body, digestive heat, and the heat that causes our hair to turn gray are all categorized as the fire element. Those who have the fire element in excess and give in to anger fast age fast, owing to the excessive heat they produce that burns the body. What is the wind element? Our body can sit erect because of the supporting force within it. This supporting force is the wind element. Moreover, we can move our limbs or move our hands, flex and stretch, because of the wind element. So anything that moves, vibrates, or pushes is also the characteristic of the wind element. By investigating this body with wisdom from the top of the head down to the soles of the feet again and again, you will find only the characteristics of these four elements: hardness, roughness, flowing, cohesion, heat, cold, supporting, pushing, and so on. And if you keep on discerning these four elements, concentration will develop until eventually you see the body emitting light. By continuing to discern the four elements in the body, you will notice many billions of very tiny particles. These particles are always arising and passing away, in a state of flux. Some meditators see that the whole body is bubbling, even breaking up or falling apart. What is changing, breaking up, and falling apart is not permanent. It is impermanent, transient, and fleeting. How can the body that is impermanent, changing, arising, and passing away, and disintegrating ensure happiness? It cannot. One also cannot control the process of arising and passing away. One cannot say, "Arising, please stop. I only want ceasing." You cannot stop the process of arising and ceasing. It follows of its own nature. So if we cling, if we are attached to this body, which in the ultimate sense is only a heap of elements that are arising and passing away, then we are attached to something that is dukkha, because what is impermanent is dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. Understanding the true nature of this body allows us to let go of our attachment to it. We have no choice but to let go. Since the body cannot be held on to, the mind naturally will let go of clinging to it. Once detachment from the body develops, when the body changes, falls sick, grows old, and the hair turns gray or white, we do not feel depressed. We do not feel mental anguish. Whatever happens to our body, we remain equanimous. This is another type of happiness, the happiness that comes from non-attachment to the body. Now we come to non-attachment to the mind. The mind can be divided into four aggregates: feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, formations aggregate, and consciousness aggregate. 1. Feeling aggregate. There are three types of feelings: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. We like pleasant feelings, dislike unpleasant feelings, and are ignorant of neutral feelings. We react in the same pattern throughout our lives. Feeling is just a mental factor, not a self. Feeling has the characteristic of experiencing the desirable and undesirable aspect of the object. When we enjoy a piece of chocolate, it is pleasant feeling that experiences the desirable taste of chocolate, not a self that experiences it. Where do these feelings come from? These feelings come from the six contacts. The six contacts are eye contact, when the eye meets with a pleasant, agreeable, visible form, pleasant feeling arises, and we start to cling to this feeling. We want it to continue and to increase. Dependent on that pleasant feeling, craving arises. However, if the visible object is not agreeable, unpleasant feelings arise, and we want to push it away. This activates the latent defilement of anger. If the visible object is neutral to the eyes, neutral feeling will arise. 2. Ear contact. When somebody praises us, the sound is very pleasant to the ear. Because of that pleasant feeling, even in our dreams, we smile. When we meet with that person, we look for more praise. So whenever there are pleasant feelings, the mind starts to crave, to grasp. This is the nature of the mind. This is why the Buddha states in the doctrine of dependent origination, dependent on feeling, craving arises. Nose contact. Whenever the nose comes into contact with a fragrant smell, a pleasant feeling arises. The pleasant feeling makes both the mind and body comfortable. Tongue contact. Whenever some delicious food touches the tongue, a pleasant feeling will arise. For example, when a piece of chocolate cake touches the tongue, sensitivity, oh, what a pleasant feeling. Because of that feeling, one stretches out one's hand, wanting one more piece of the cake. Stretching out the hand to get one more piece is a sign of craving. Grasping the cake and not wanting to let it go is clinging. Bodily contact. Whenever the body touches some soft or smooth material or is caressed by a loved one, a pleasant feeling is stimulated. The pleasantness spreads and flows over the body, making one exclaim, "My gosh, how joyful!" Mental contact. Whenever the mind thinks of all the fantasies, daydreams, and pleasant thoughts, pleasant feelings will arise out of the pleasant mind contact. From the time we were born until now, we have experienced billions of pleasant feelings arising from these six contacts. Do any of the pleasant feelings you have experienced remain? Are they still here? Or have they passed away? Not one of them has remained. This shows that all feelings are impermanent. We have just verified this for ourselves. And yet, whenever we encounter a pleasant feeling, we always hope it will stay forever. We always forget that it will also pass away, that it is transient. On the other hand, when we encounter an unpleasant feeling, we always hope the unpleasant feeling will quickly go away. Quickly go away, don't last. So we are not accepting things as they really are. We are trying to control the whole process. We only want things our way, and our habitual pattern of reactions, grasping what we like and pushing away what we don't like, reinforces the identity view of a self that is in control. No matter how much we want our pleasant feelings to last forever and our unpleasant feelings to cease immediately, these feelings will never comply with our wishes. Feelings arise and pass away according to causes and conditions. Their occurrence is beyond our control, and when the cause for their cessation is present, then the feelings simply pass away. This understanding that all feelings are not self, not subject to ownership or control, are transient like bubbles, helps us to let go of the attachment to pleasant feelings and the aversion to unpleasant feelings. Just look upon them as passing clouds in the sky. Not bothered by any feelings, you will then be truly happy. 2. Perception aggregate. Now let us consider the perception aggregate and see how one can gain happiness not by clinging to it. Let us first study what is the meaning of perception. Perception has the characteristic of knowing the quality of an object, so that the perceived object can be recognized again. For example, when you first saw a bird flying, your perception recognized the bird by its two wings flying in the sky. Perception made a mark or a note. A bird has two wings, and kept it in your memory. The next time your eyes saw a bird again, this perception immediately recognized it by way of its two wings and perceived that this is a bird. So perception has two functions, A, to perceive the specific characteristics of the object, and B, to recognize it again. As long as our wisdom is not fully developed through meditation, our five senses always perceive what is seen, heard, smelled, tasted, and touched as permanent, happiness, and a self. When we were born, we started crying for food. The moment our mother's milk came in contact with our tongue, very pleasant feelings arose. We started to make a mental note, food gives pleasant feelings, and our perception kept these experiences in our memory. Every time when we were fed, we felt good. When we were fed repeatedly, the same pleasant feelings repeatedly arose and they eventually got imprinted in the mind, giving rise to the perception that these pleasant feelings are permanent. Even now, most of us unceasingly crave for food because we have learned over time to perceive that food gives us pleasant feelings and that these pleasant feelings are permanent. In addition, when our eyes first saw our beloved parents, when our ears heard their sweet voices, when our bodies felt the lovely touch of our mothers, we perceived, oh, very good, great. The happiness that came from what was repeatedly seen, heard, smelled, tasted, and touched became perceived as permanent. Further, we also wrongly perceived that there was a self, a permanent self, that perceived these experiences. This is called sanya vipalasa, perverted perception, perception that is contrary to the truth. Once perceived wrongly, this perception becomes very deeply rooted in our mental stream. This habitual perception, based on a distorted view of permanence, happiness, and self, is responsible for our frustrations when our life experience shows the opposite. The vicissitudes of life have taught us that many events are beyond our control. They happen as a result of causes and conditions. If we had not delusively perceived everything as permanent and happy, would we feel suffering when things change? To perceive things as they really are, in accordance with the truth, makes the mind unshakable under all circumstances. What does it mean, things as they really are? All formations, everything in this world, are subject to change, alteration, and destruction. Everything is in a state of constant flux, characterized by repeated arising and passing away, and because of this we feel oppressed. This oppression is suffering, or dukkha. Dukkha is inherent in all changing things. Therefore, correcting our distorted perception that everything lasts, contains happiness, and is identified as a self, is the key to happiness. How do we correct this perception? By constantly contemplating impermanence until we successfully see that everything changes, is inherently unsatisfactory, and is beyond the control of a self. With corrected perception, the mind is steadfast. 3. Formations aggregate. A formation is the construction of a condition. The function of a formation is to accumulate karma. Its characteristic is in forming, in adding all mental factors together. The formation's aggregate includes lust, anger, jealousy, avarice, fear, remorse, worry, faith, joy, compassion, mindfulness, wisdom, concentration, and so on. They are merely mental states arising due to causes, performing their functions, then immediately passing away. For example, at the present moment, you are hearing my words joyfully, as reading the Dharma is a delight. The mental factor of joy, at this moment, is performing its function of permeating you with lightness of the body and mind, which is its purpose. This joy should not be regarded as I or as myself. If I now change my tone and words to speak to you harshly, to scold you without any reason, the causes for the arising of joy will come to cessation. In their place, anger that is dormant in the mental stream may come to the surface instead, because the conditions for its arising are ready. Thus, when the conditions for joy or anger to arise come into being, then joy or anger, as the case may be, will simply arise. All mental formations are governed by causality. To see things in accordance with causality without any controlling entity is the key to happiness. 4. Consciousness aggregate. The consciousness aggregate has the single characteristic of awareness of an object. There are 6 classes of consciousness: eye consciousness, seeing a form; ear consciousness, hearing a sound; nose consciousness, smelling a smell; tongue consciousness, tasting a taste; body consciousness, sensing a tangible object; mind consciousness, being aware of a mental object. In the blink of an eye, millions of consciousnesses arise and vanish at tremendous speed. Owing to this incredibly rapid succession, the rise and fall of consciousness is hardly distinguishable, and thus it appears to be continuous. This apparent continuity implies a perpetual awareness rather than what is really happening, discrete, rapidly succeeding mind moments operating in a fixed, ordered process that is giving rise to awareness. A simile may make this clearer. When we are watching television and at the same time eating chips and smelling their fragrance, it seems as if seeing, tasting, smelling, and listening are all happening simultaneously. We cannot distinguish that eye consciousness only sees, ear consciousness only hears, nose consciousness only smells, and tongue consciousness only tastes. Each consciousness, in fact, performs its own function at different times, but in rapid succession. Not knowing what is actually happening, we wrongly think it is the same eye who sees, tastes, smells, and hears simultaneously. Thus, the Buddha likens consciousness to a magician, making what is unreal seem real to deceive us. These 5 aggregates, body, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness, comprise the self, and craving and attachment arise dependent upon them. When there is attachment, there is suffering. How can we practice to free ourselves from attachment to this body and mind, from the 5 aggregates? Mindfulness and wisdom are the key. Mindfulness comes face to face with the object in focus and does not forget it. Mindfulness is free from judgment, bias, prejudice, and preference. Instead, mindfulness simply observes, recognizes, allows, and accepts any phenomena arising in the present moment for what they really are, neither embellishing them nor detracting from them. There are 2 factors in mindfulness: recognition and acceptance. For example, when anger has arisen in your mind, you may recognize, "There is anger in my mind." Accept it. Accept the anger as it is. Do not try to push away what is unpleasant and cling to what is pleasant. Reacting in such a way does not free us from suffering. Accepting the anger as it really is allows the wisdom to see the impermanence of anger. Wisdom means to see things as they really are, in accordance with the truth, as impermanent, suffering, and not a self. Wisdom requires several actions. First, not to self-identify. When any phenomenon arises from the mind and body, for example, an unpleasant bodily feeling, we must not identify with this unpleasant feeling as I, thinking, "I'm uncomfortable, my pain." Instead, we must disidentify from the feeling by mentally noting, "This unpleasant feeling is not I, not mine, not myself." An unpleasant feeling in and of itself is unbearable and gives rise to pain. If one does not disidentify with the feeling, the mind will immediately identify it as I. This self-identification intensifies the pain, and as a result, one suffers even more. This suffering due to bodily pain is called dukkha-dukkha. On the other hand, if you self-identify with pleasant feelings as I, you also suffer. But this time you suffer from craving. When there is craving, both the mind and body are tormented. When the pleasant feeling disappears, as it must, you suffer again from the change and the loss of the pleasant feeling. This is suffering due to change. Viparinama dukkha. So to free oneself from different types of suffering, one does not self-identify with whatever phenomenon has arisen. The next step in developing wisdom is to investigate. Investigation of cause and effect is very important in the teaching of the Buddha. It constitutes the mental factor of wisdom. Using the above example, if a feeling is not I, not mine, and not myself, what then is this feeling? You investigate the characteristic and function of the feeling. Its characteristic is to be felt, and its function is to experience the desirable and undesirable aspects of the object. For example, when a man sees a charming girl, her image has all the desirable attributes to arouse a pleasant feeling in him. A man just feels it as pleasant feeling. If he further investigates the cause of his pleasant feeling, he realizes it is owing to pleasant eye contact. Pleasant eye contact is the cause, pleasant feeling the effect. When the sweetness of chocolate impinges the tongue sensitivity, pleasant feelings arise. Before the chocolate cake touches the tongue, no pleasant feelings arise. Only at the moment of contact do pleasant feelings arise. But if an extremely bitter taste impinges the tongue sensitivity, unpleasant feelings may arise. You then understand, oh, feeling is just an effect of the cause, which is contact. After investigating in this way how the contact of different sense objects on their corresponding sense bases gives rise to different types of feelings, you will come to realize that each different feeling arises dependent on the type of contact, either pleasant or unpleasant, and you know with certainty for yourself that this feeling is an effect of a cause, contact. The whole process is merely cause and effect. This is why feeling is not defined as I, mine, or myself. If feeling were I, then whenever that feeling perishes, the I would have also perished. However, through your own experiences, you see that though many different types of feelings have passed away, the so-called I still remains. Thus, it does not seem fit to assume that the feelings were I. The non-self nature of the phenomenon is revealed through the investigation of cause and effect. As the cause, contact, keeps changing, then the effect, feeling, keeps changing as well. Whatever keeps changing is impermanent. This brings us to the next step in the process of developing wisdom, contemplating impermanence. Mentally, you should mark each phenomenon that arises as impermanent, noting impermanent, impermanent, impermanent. We note impermanence for four reasons. 1. To undo our distorted perception of permanence that blocks us from seeing things as they really are. 2. To synchronize or harmonize the mind with the way things are. Everything in the universe is continually changing. By synchronizing our mind with it, this universal truth of change will manifest itself very fast. 3. To sever the craving. Thinking of the six sense objects, six sense bases, six contacts, and six feelings as permanent and happiness nurtures craving. By nurturing craving, one cannot be free from suffering. 4. To teach the mind to let go. Since we cannot hold on to any phenomenon, the wisest way to deal with it is to let go of our attachment to it. When consciousness does not cling to pleasant feeling, for instance, Then this pleasant feeling passes away. You will not feel pain or stress because you already know it's impermanent. You are able to remain equanimous. This equanimity is a great type of happiness. If you practice in this way, you will find that your happiness will increase gradually, day by day, because your knowing mind is now in accord with the truth of anicca, or impermanence. Seeing clearly, you are able to let go of the clinging to the five aggregates. The Buddha said, "The five aggregates of clinging are the noble truth of suffering. This truth must be thoroughly understood. The five aggregates are the same as the mind and body, and we cling to them in two ways, by way of wrong view and craving. With wrong view, we identify with these five aggregates as I and as myself, thus giving rise to strong craving and to clinging. As the Buddha said, the cause for our suffering, or the noble truth of the origin of suffering, is craving. So in order to free ourselves from suffering, we have to let go of the cause, which is craving. As you become familiar with contemplating each experience as impermanent, impermanent, with the maturing of one's wisdom, there comes a day when one actually sees the constant arising and passing away of all phenomena. Then the knowledge arises that what is constantly changing cannot bring happiness. It is only dukkha, or dissatisfaction. The Buddha said, whatever is anicca, impermanent, or dukkha, suffering, should not be regarded as atta, self. Since no controlling entity can be found, it is anatta, not a self. When your concentration, mindfulness, and wisdom become more mature, then no matter what arises in your mind and body, wisdom sees it only as the arising of suffering, and whatever ceases is just the cessation of suffering. One remembers what the Buddha said, all formations are transient. Having arisen, they cease. Their cessation is bliss. Having repeatedly seen anicca, dukkha, and anatta, the mind becomes disenchanted with the five aggregates. Being disenchanted, one feels dispassionate and is willing to let go of craving. When the mind no longer clings to anything whatsoever, this experience is called freedom of the heart. This can be achieved if one applies mindfulness and wisdom from moment to moment. This freedom of the heart is the true happiness that we can experience in our daily life. Whatever arises in this mind and body, pain, happiness, sorrow, like and dislike, is in fact giving us a chance to experience the truth of impermanence. Take mindfulness and wisdom as your refuge to free yourself from all types of entanglement and suffering. This is the true happiness.